Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Luke's English podcast is made possible thanks to donations from my listeners, and if you'd like to make a donation, just click one of the yellow PayPal buttons on my website. The podcast is also supported by sponsors. The sponsor for this episode is iTalki, and if you'd like to arrange one-to-one lessons with a qualified teacher to work on your grammar, your speaking, your pronunciation, or English for specific situations like job interviews or exams or things, just use iTalki. It's probably the most convenient way to find one-to-one teachers and conversation partners. It's like shopping for an English teacher. They have little videos where they introduce themselves. You can see breakdowns of their qualifications and their experience. Also reviews by other students who've used them. It's a really complete system. And remember, when you buy some talking time, iTalki will send you a voucher for a free lesson because you listen to this podcast. To get the offer, go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, folks. Welcome to Luke's English podcast. How are you today? I hope you're doing fine. So this episode is a ramble. I'm just going to ramble in this episode. I've got a few notes in front of me, but everything else is just off the top of my head. Let's see if I can keep this up for about an hour. I think I probably should be able to do that because I've got lots of things that I just want to ramble on about. So who knows, this might become a double ramble, but we will see. I've done rambling episodes before, of course, as you'll know if you're a long-term listener. More recently, the sort of rambling ones where I kind of talk about news and things. But I first started doing those rambling episodes, I think it was probably after about 50, 60, 70 episodes of the podcast. And at that time, I had previously always kind of prepared every episode quite carefully. I used to have a notepad in those days. I used to write all of my notes down by hand, and then I would sort of record the podcast with the notepad in front of me. In some episodes, you can hear the pages of the notepad being turned. And then after, about 60 or 70 episodes, I thought to myself, I wonder if I can just do an episode where I've got nothing written down at all, nothing prepared, and I just try and talk for about 30 or 40 minutes or something. I used to give myself these challenges. That was quite fun and quite interesting and sort of a new thing. I kind of realized a new thing about doing the podcast, which is that I could kind of connect with the audience in a different way when I don't have a script and I don't have everything written down in advance. It somehow makes it more immediate. And this is also sort of central to what I'm trying to do with the podcast, which is to help you learn English, but in a slightly different way. It's a sort of a different approach to helping you learn English. The idea is that I'm kind of providing you with this personalized content as if it's just a person talking to you in the normal way. It doesn't have all the kind of formal stuff, language-wise, that you would get in things like BBC News reports or even just normal radio programs where the presenters talk in a certain way. Because this is a podcast, it's so much more personal. So it's kind of like one person just talking to you. You could be sitting at a table in the pub or in a cafe or something, and it's just like having a conversation. So, you know, that's the idea. And by engaging with English in a personal way like this on a regular basis, listening longer, long term, that's just a very healthy thing for your English because you get this regular input of spoken English. And it kind of, I mean, you know, to an extent, there's the idea that if you just listen to it and you're paying attention and you kind of are involved somehow in what you're hearing, that you'll acquire language as a result. But also there's just the idea that you can constantly notice bits of language, certain features, chunks of English and things like that. And perhaps it's interesting to kind of follow a kind of monologue like this and just sort of notice the way the whole thing is structured together. So that's the general idea. It's ultimately all for your English. Now, obviously, as I am an online English teacher, I suppose, a podcaster, and people visit my website and see my profile on social media and stuff like that, people do write to me with questions. And sometimes those questions are, to be honest, far too big for me to be able to answer in like one email to one person. The questions are things like, how do I learn English with your podcast? I should probably do a video about it and put it on the front page of my website. But in the meantime, I would suggest to any of you out there who are sort of listening, maybe if you're new to the podcast or something and you're listening and you're thinking, how can I use this podcast to help me really learn English? Then go into the episode archive on my website, teacherluke.co.uk. Just click episodes in the menu and you'll get the entire archive. And there are loads of episodes in there about how to learn English and advice about learning English, and also specific episodes in which I'm teaching grammar, vocab, pronunciation, idioms, phrasal verbs, and stuff like that. I'd probably start with episode 174 and also episode 568. Those are both specifically about how you can learn English or improve your English with the podcast. But there are lots of other episodes in the archive that you could check out. So there you go. That's maybe an idea for those of you who are looking for specific advice on learning English. It's actually 10 years... It's the 10-year anniversary of my website this month. In fact, yesterday was officially 10 years. Yeah, the website's 10 years old. And it still looks 10 years old as well, to be honest. My website does still look a bit old-fashioned. It looks a bit like a blog. Do you remember there was that time a few years ago when people kept kind of referring to my website as a blog? And it's, you know, I kept having to say it's not a blog, it's a podcast. And I won even a few awards and stuff for the best blog. So that's the website there, you know. I've worked on it over the years. I've done all of it myself. I've learned how to do WordPress publishing and editing and customizing and stuff. Learned it all myself. The website, I have to say, behind the scenes, the whole thing is held together with like string and sellotape. You know, it's like sticky tape and string and bits of rope just holding the whole thing together. It's extremely shoddy back there. It's a complete mess, I have to say. But basically, on the, you know, for most of you, for those, and it's for me, it's a problem, because like the dashboard and all the plugins I've got and stuff make the website very heavy for the administrator. So when I'm logged in as an administrator, it's very heavy. It takes ages to do anything. But for you guys who are not logged in, just using the website, I think it works, doesn't it? I think it does. And the episode archive is, I think, you know, it's a veritable gold mine of content to help you learn English. I mean, you'll have to forgive my slightly rambling style, but I've kind of become known for doing this, you know, kind of going on. So you'll have to forgive that. I mean, there are some of the episodes in the archive. I've tried to stop doing it these days, but there are some back there, maybe sort of between episode 200 and 400 or something, where there's quite a lot of rambling, particularly in the opening part of the episode, where I'm just kind of rambling on about, I don't know what, like the rain or something. And so some people might think, well, you know, when's he actually going to get to the point? And certainly if this episode, I mean, if you don't like those sorts of rambling moments, then this episode will not be for you, because this is going to be an entirely rambly episode from start to finish. But I'm going to cover a few different topics here, and let me just give you a rundown of just like little words and phrases I've got written here in front of me. So I've got the Rick Thompson report and politics, my recording setup, a book recommendation, Beatle stuff, Beatle news, Star Wars, Bill Bailey, the musical comedian. And I think that's pretty much it at the moment. So let's see if we can get through, if I can ramble through those topics And if this takes, you know, a significant amount of time, it might become a double episode. So the Rick Thompson report, I've written that down because people have been requesting a new episode of the Rick Thompson report in the light of all of the stuff that's been going on in Westminster recently with the complex business of Boris Johnson attempting to get a Brexit deal, or maybe he's not. Maybe he's doing that in order to try and somehow get no deal, or is he going to go for an extension? What's the EU going to do? Is Boris Johnson's deal actually better than Theresa May's deal? Is it the same thing, basically, with just a couple of changes? Does it provide security for the Northern Ireland situation? Or is this some kind of weird, ambiguous fudge? You know, all those sorts of questions. And what's going to happen? Is there going to be a general election? Are MPs going to vote for Boris's deal? I mean, you know, people are, fair enough, of course, people are asking all those questions. I was actually with my parents this weekend. I mean, it's a bit sort of tricky, the whole subject of Brexit, because what happens is when we're together, we talk about stuff, you know, all the usual things that you talk about with your parents and your family and things. And then the subject of Brexit comes up and we start getting into it and it starts to get a bit kind of heated and stuff. And then someone says, oh, you know, we've got to stop talking about it because it's too depressing. And so that's kind of the issue. We did talk about it a bit, my dad and me and, you know, my mom and my wife and stuff. My daughter's too young to talk. I mean, she obviously doesn't understand Brexit, but she'd probably say no. You know, if I said Brexit to her, she'd probably just automatically say no, because she basically says no to everything, even stuff she wants to do. So if, you know, if like, she, you know, she's hungry and you say, do you want to have dinner? And she'll go, no. And then you give her dinner and she eats it, you know. So you literally hold the spoon in front of her and she's going, no, 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 no. And then she eats it. So, you know, I don't think she's really in a position to commentate on Brexit. But anyway, so I said to my dad, look, you know, he said to me, he said, you know, are you going to record a podcast this weekend? And I was thinking, well, you know, I should do one on Brexit, really. But we ultimately decided that it was just too kind of too depressing, actually, and annoying and upsetting and all that sort of thing, and just not what we wanted to spend our time doing at the weekend. But they are coming back soon in a few days. So when they come back, my dad and me, and maybe my mum as well, maybe I'll do one with my mum separately, I don't know. Maybe we'll do a podcast and then publish it. But, you know, just the subject of Brexit is just very complicated. I mean, some things seem to be positive about it, like there's a potential for maybe a slight potential for a second referendum, but I think it's very unlikely. There was a massive march at the weekend, a huge protest about Brexit, and the march was all in support of a second referendum. And obviously there are arguments, you know, against that. Of course, there's tons of pushback in terms of, you know, attitudes and stuff. Brexit is incredibly divisive. So you've got almost a 50-50 split in the country between people who quite passionately believe we should stay and just keep things as they are, because things are really quite good at the moment in terms of our relationship with the EU. And any deal that we're going to get is not going to be as good as what we've got now, which is, you know, a fantastic deal, actually. So, right, the 50-50 split. So there's like 50% of the nation think it's, you know, a bad idea, basically, and that we should, you know, just call the whole thing off. It's going to be very costly and all the other reasons. And then 50%, you know, believe that it's all about taking back control and that somehow this is going to be good for Britain. But it's actually, you know, so complicated, because you've got all these different possibilities where you have things like, you know, some kind of deal. Which deal would it be? And analysing Boris's deal at the moment. And then the prospect of no deal. And then the prospect of a general election or maybe a second referendum. And then what do you do after that, you know? And then maybe even just scrapping the whole thing completely. It's like we're at a horrible crossroads, and it's log jam, you know, it's kind of like a traffic jam, and it's very, very hard to tell what's going to happen next. With my family, we all agree that we don't trust Boris Johnson. That's just our personal view, but I mean, it's based on a lot of precedent in terms of his dishonesty in the past, in not just in politics, but in other work that he's done. He was fired from several jobs for lying as a journalist and other things. And there's this sense with him that, you know, no one's really sure what he's doing. Is he playing a game in order to try and seal no deal? Why do people want no deal anyway? And there's this suggestion that it's all about sort of investment banking and hedging investments against the outcome of no deal Brexit and stuff like that. Anyway, politics. Oh man, really? Like sometimes I politics is difficult because I know every time I talk about it, I don't mean to rub people up the wrong way. I really don't, because I'm sure there are people out there who disagree with me. I'm not trying to ruffle any feathers or rub people up the wrong way. I'm really not. I'm just talking about a subject that is very close to home, you know. And obviously, on this podcast, I talk about British things, and Brexit is naturally a big part of that. And I can't help having my own personal views. I feel strongly about it for personal reasons, of course. So, you know, when I talk about it, I can't help, you know, giving my opinion. But yeah, politics is always a tricky one because it is very divisive. You know, they say don't never discuss religion or politics at, you know, a dinner party or something. It's probably true also on the podcast. So I don't mean to I'm not trying to be controversial and say things that people are going to disagree with. I'm not trying to preach. Okay, that's not what I'm doing. I'm just sort of giving my opinion. I think I'll move on from Brexit to what's next on my list. So my recording setup, okay, I'll fly through this very quickly because this is probably just me self-indulgently talking about all of my kit. But someone did write to me recently. I don't know which platform it's on, because obviously I publish the podcast on my website. It also goes up onto YouTube, by the way. All my audio episodes now go up onto YouTube, and you can get the automatic subtitles, the auto-generated subtitles there, which are mostly accurate. It's actually pretty good. When it's just me talking on my own, they are probably about 99% accurate, which is really great. So anyway, yes, so the various platforms. So people get in touch with me on lots of different platforms. So I can't remember where it was, but someone asked me to explain what the microphone was or what my setup was. So I'll go through it very quickly. Recently, I bought a new mixer, right? A little one-channel mixer by a company called Behringer. So that has kind of boosted my sound a little bit recently. I don't know if you could tell. I've now, though, I have like so many more dials and switches and things to deal with. So sometimes I'm kind of like playing with the dials as I'm recording to try and get the right level. So I'll go through the setup that I've got going on here. I'll keep it brief. Okay. So the most important thing I have in my podcast recording setup is a device called the Zoom H5. Zoom is a company that makes audio recorders. I think it's a Japanese company. Not sure. And they've got a range of different audio recorders. I used to use the Zoom H4, but I upgraded to the Zoom H5 a few years ago. And the great thing about this is that, first of all, it records the audio in a good file format, in a WAV form. So it's a high-quality audio file. It records it directly onto an SD card, a memory card. And that's good because it's very dependable. It's extremely reliable. If I was to record my audio episodes live into my computer, into something like GarageBand, there's always the possibility that the software is going to crash or that something's going to happen in my computer and it's going to go wrong and I'll lose everything. So I don't like to record straight into the computer. Instead, I go into one of these audio, like solid state audio recorders. I find them to be more trustworthy and also just really handy for doing the podcast. So this thing is just plugged into the mains. So it's got its power supply from the mains. And the cool thing about this is that it's got several inputs. So in its normal settings, it's got two inputs that will accept XLR cables. Those are microphone cables. They're kind of like quite fat plugs that go in the end with three pins, the sorts of things that are used on stage with microphones. So you can connect a microphone straight into one of these things. And you can also connect, in the case of what I'm doing now, my computer straight into it too. And it will record both of those tracks separately on two different tracks. So you end up with two files, which you can then blend together later on if you want to. And you've got volume controls for both of those tracks. So you can kind of make sure that you're not playing too loud or that you're not too quiet. You can kind of monitor the recording as you go. And that's brilliant. That's really, really useful. And so going into that, I have my... I'm using a Shure SM57 microphone with the larger windscreen on top. And I've found that this windscreen, it's quite large and thick, and it helps to deal with plosive sounds. Plosive sounds are those ones that come out when you do things like the P or B sounds, when large amounts of air come flying out through your mouth. Those are plosives. And so microphones often will kind of explode. They'll go poof when you do a plosive sound, unless you've got something covering the microphone. Some people use a pop filter, and I like to use windscreens, just like sort of a muffler that goes over the top of the microphone. The Shure SM57 is an industry standard microphone that's used across lots of different applications. It's used on stage for miking up people's voice. It's used for miking up different instruments, drums, guitars, and things like that. It's used in studios, and most of the recorded music that you've listened to will have been recorded on a Shure SM57 or maybe an SM58. They are the most standard microphones for most recordings and live broadcasting on stage and in studios. It's not a studio quality microphone for the radio. Those are usually kind of condenser microphones, large sort of ribbon condensers. This is a dynamic microphone. And one of the cool things about these Shure microphones, the SM57 and the SM58, how geeky is this? Very. Is that they are really tough. They're really, really solid, and you can drop them on the ground and they're absolutely fine. You could hammer a nail into a wall with one of these and it would be fine. So they're quite sturdy and good for traveling around and carrying around. So this goes, actually, before this SM57 goes into the Zoom H5, I have something else in the setup, in the chain. So the microphone goes into something called a cloud lifter. It's the CL1 mic activator cloud lifter, which is like a little blue box, and it just boosts the signal of the microphone. And actually, I use that one with my other microphone, which is the Zoom SM7B, which is a really great microphone with a lovely sound, but it requires a lot more power. So I use the cloud lifter to boost the power to the microphone. And it helps, you know, why is that good, Luke? Well, when your microphone is getting more power, it means that the signal is stronger, which means that there's less hiss in the background. Hiss is like ambient noise, like this kind of shh kind of sound. That's hiss. And so when your microphone is getting more power, there's basically more signal and less hiss, which is a good thing. It means that, you know, you've got more quietness in the background, which basically makes a better recording. So I'm not using the SM7B, which is a wicked microphone that was used apparently by Michael Jackson when he recorded Thriller. It was also used by David Bowie on his last album. So this is another standard microphone. You see it a lot. For example, Joe Rogan uses this one. I'm not using that one because I wanted to use just a microphone in my hand. I wanted a handheld mic. So that's why I've got the SM57. This is fascinating, isn't it? So from so the mic goes into the cloud lifter, which gives it a boost. And that then goes into the mixer, which has just got one channel on it. And it just the cable goes straight into the mixer. And then I can control, for example, EQ. I can give it more treble like this. I can go really trebly. And that sounds a bit too much. It's like snakes. So I can give it a bit more treble, and also bass. I can go all the way up on the bass like this, and then I sound like I'm very bassy, and just bring that back there a bit. Okay. And also I've got things like compression. So compression is on max at the moment. If I remove the compression, I'm going to get quieter. So I'm much quieter now. There's no compression. I'm going to move the compression back up again. And compression is the thing that makes me sound like a radio DJ. Because radio DJs use a lot of compression on their voices when they do radio presentations. So compression basically means that it sort of squashes the audio. Imagine the audio is like a big wave, like that going up and down, a big wave. Compression takes that wave and squashes it so it's all sort of normalized, I think. So it squashes, for example, the extra loud bits become a bit quieter and the quieter bits become a bit louder, and it all becomes at the same kind of frequency, and it's like one single band which you can then make louder. So compression just kind of gives it that professional sort of quality where everything sounds full. It sounds like there's a lot of presence to the sound. Okay, so then from the mixer, I go into the Zoom H5, and that's how I record all of the noises. There you go. So I hope that answers your question, whoever you were out there in podcast land asking me about that. I've got a book recommendation for you. Recently, I read this book, which I had read before, but I had been thinking about it. So I decided to find myself another copy of it and read it again. And I wasn't disappointed. In fact, I think I found it even more interesting the second time round. The book I'm talking about is called One Train Later by Andy Summers. Andy Summers was, and sort of still is, the guitarist in The Police. You know, that band with Sting and Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers on guitar. And Andy Summers wrote this book. I think it was published in 2006. And it's basically his memoir describing his life in music, starting with how he learned the guitar growing up as a child and how he got involved in local bands in Bournemouth. On the south coast of England, and he sort of ended up becoming a professional musician. And Andy Summers had an amazing career, and it's really interesting in his book. So the book is great for several reasons. First thing I'll say is basically rock biographies, okay? Rock biographies. I don't know if you're like me, but I love rock biographies. I love reading those stories of these guys who for some reason got obsessed by music, probably in the 50s or something, and they all learnt guitar on like these terrible little acoustic guitars, and then they got sort of into bands, and the whole thing becomes like a snowball as the band rockets to success and the world changes, and then drugs get involved and there's the music industry issues and all that stuff and all the personal issues between the band members. There are so many really great stories about rock musicians and rock bands. And I've read loads and loads of these rock biographies about sort of anyone and everyone I can lay my hands on. But I think this is one of my favorites. It's this one. And the other one is the Miles Davis book, which is written by Miles Davis. And that is an incredible story, an incredible book, all written in his voice. I think he worked with a writer called Quincy Troupe. I think that's how you say his name. And apparently Miles basically kind of like just talked to Quincy, and Quincy kind of wrote it all down. And so the story is written in Miles's voice.
So Miles Davis used to speak kind of like this. He had this whispering voice.
And he used to swear a lot. And he's like, yeah,
when I heard that music, it was all up in my body like a motherfucker.
Like, oh, I can't do that voice for long. But that's what Miles Davis's book is written like, that, all in his voice with all his kind of his dialect and slang and stuff. But anyway, One Train Later is my other favorite one because, okay, two reasons. One, Andy Summers is just a really good writer. He's able to write in a very clear and very engaging and entertaining way. And I think this is exactly what you need from a book that you're using to learn English. You need a book that flows from one page to the next. The prose is very easy and very natural and very evocative. He really does paint a very vivid picture of what it's like to be either a musician who's sort of dealing with great levels of success, or also a musician dealing with great levels of like failure and lack of success. So he's a great writer, And I think if you're learning English with a book, you want something that allows you to read more and read more quickly. You don't want to get bogged down in like complex, impenetrable writing. You want something that flows quite easily, a sort of a page turner. And this one does. And that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean it's kind of superficial. It's actually quite deep, and it goes into quite a lot of depth in his personal life and his feelings about what happens when you become one of the most successful musicians on the planet. So there's that, the writing style, which is really helpful, I think. And also there is the fact that he grew up all the way from the sort of very beginning. In fact, he really became famous quite late. And Andy Summers was of the generation that kind of started playing rhythm and blues music and rock and roll music in the early 60s and late 50s, and then sort of moved into playing rock music with rock bands, that psychedelic music, experimental forms of music, and taking it more avant-garde, maybe with some jazz influences and progressive rock. And he really sort of went through every single genre change, which is the other fantastic thing about this story, is that it's a really good sort of history of guitar music from the point of view of a British musician. And it goes through every phase, you know, the kind of skiffle period, the kind of folky, kind of jazzy, folky skiffle stuff that people were doing before rock and roll arrived. And then there's rock and roll and rhythm and blues and the blues and jazz and all that stuff. And then all the way through progressive rock into punk then, because obviously Andy Summers, although he had some success in his career in the 60s and early 70s, by the sort of mid 70s, his career was really not going anywhere, and he was suffering, and he was broke and stuff like that. And then punk sort of came along and revitalized the music scene. And he got involved in this band with Stuart Copeland and Sting, which later became The Police. And then there was this whole massive explosion in his career. And at one point, The Police were probably the biggest band in the world. And so you get this incredible roller coaster of narrative, and also just a history of music as well. It's a fantastic book. It's really easy to read, and I highly recommend it. One Train Later by Andy Summers. You should be able to get it in any decent bookshop, and probably a few rubbish bookshops as well. It's well worth a read if you like a good rock and roll biography. And it's one of those books that you might not sort of expect to be one of the best. You know, you'd think, well, which one's going to be the best? It'll be like the sort of the Led Zeppelin book or something like that. But actually, this one is fantastic. On the subject of music, I'm a huge Beatles fan. And it's quite an interesting time for Beatle fans, because this year is the 50th anniversary of Abbey Road, the official last album that was ever recorded by the Beatles. And so the sort of 50th edition has come out, and it's full of interesting remixes by Giles Martin, the son of George Martin, of course, the Beatles producer. So Giles Martin is now part of the sort of Beatles family, and he is their official sort of remixer and curator. And so there are some really interesting things. There's a full extended special edition, which I think has about three vinyl discs, three different sort of selections. And it includes lots and lots of outtakes and interesting morsels and different sort of takes of songs that we've never heard before, and you get the chance to listen to isolated parts. It's fascinating. And also, it seems that the general narrative about the Beatles at the end of the band's career seems to be changing a little bit, for several reasons. One of them, I think, is because of a new recording that was unearthed, and it's a recording of a meeting between Paul, George and John. I think Ringo was away at the time, and they're talking, it's around about the time of Abbey Road, which was actually the last album they recorded together. And they're talking, and now the official story is that it was very bitter at the end, that especially the Let It Be recording sessions were very bitter. There was lots of fighting and arguing, and they hated it, and they hated each other. And it was horrible. And then they decided to kind of club together for Abbey Road, but they all knew it would be the last album. So there's this kind of sense that they were going to do one last thing, and that would be it, and then they'd wash their hands of it. But according to this, the recording of this meeting, it's not quite the case, because they were actually discussing recording another album. They were talking about plans for another one. And all of them seemed to be quite enthusiastic about it, including John. So this is interesting that it seems that it wasn't all over at that point. So interesting change in the story. And the other thing is that Peter Jackson, yes, the guy who directed the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Peter Jackson has been given access to all of the master tapes that were recorded during filming of the Get Back sessions, which then later became the film Let It Be. So Peter Jackson is known now for being able to restore old and probably damaged video footage, because he did that film. Oh, what was the film called? It was about World War One. They shall never grow old, I think it's called. Peter Jackson, they shall not grow old. Okay, so They Shall Not Grow Old is a film that was made by Peter Jackson last year, I think, maybe the year before. And it's about World War One, and it's made using old footage, which has been kind of cleaned up digitally. So they've managed to do lots of things. So it becomes sort of very clear, almost like modern footage. And they've taken audio and spliced it together, and they've actually recorded they've recorded audio backing tracks for parts of the video that don't have audio. So they've recreated the audio and created a film which has tons of footage of World War One that's incredibly fresh looking, like it's new footage. And so anyway, the part of that is the digital technology that they've used to kind of clean up these old videos. And so Peter Jackson is going to do the same thing with the videos from Let It Be, which is really interesting. And there's there's tons of stuff, tons of audio as well. And apparently, like the other recording I talked about, it seems that the video footage, in fact, tells a different story than the one we've had. The official story has been that the Beatles didn't get on, it was miserable. But apparently the footage shows a really different kind of situation where they're getting on, there's a lot of fun, enjoyment, and joy going on. So I can't wait for that film to come out. I think it comes out next year, so I'm very much looking forward to it. I can't remember what it's called at this stage, but I'm really looking forward to it. Talking of films, he said, making a clumsy link between two items in his list. The new Star Wars trailer dropped today. That's right. It's the final trailer for Star Wars Episode 9. The Rise of Skywalker. Okay, so I have to do the obligatory Luke's English Podcast Star Wars chat here, folks. Okay, you know I'm a Star Wars fan. Some of you are too. I have to talk about it. It's just close to my heart. I'm sorry. Now, what's going on with Star Wars? What's happening with Star Wars? Now, okay, so I like it. I just love immersing myself in the world of Star Wars for an hour or two, and just the pure entertainment of it and the nostalgia value. I just get a kick out of it. I really enjoy it. And I liked The Last Jedi, which is not something that you hear people say very often, is it? It's not. But I admit I liked it. When I went to see it the first time, I hadn't seen any press relating to it at all. I hadn't seen any comments in any pages on the internet, no reviews. I saw it the first day it was released in France, which was 2 days before it got released in most other places. And I'm not saying that because I'm bragging that I got in early. I don't care about that. I'm just saying that I hadn't read anyone else's comments about it before I saw it. So I went in. And at that time, my wife was pregnant. She was going to give birth to our daughter at any time. So I had my phone in my hand throughout the entire film just to check in case something happened. And I was ready to just run out of the cinema because obviously I have my priorities. Okay. So it was kind of a strange time. I remember watching the film, and on several occasions, I was welling up and the tears came down my cheek. On several occasions, and I laughed in the moments of comedy, even though they are very clumsy. You know, if you p- put those moments into the Star Wars canon, when you realize this is an official Star Wars film and they're making jokes like that, I can see how people got upset. I didn't mind. I don't care. I feel like I've got nothing to lose when it comes to Star Wars. I feel like I've had my cake with Star Wars. You know, it's been great. And I just don't know if they can ever make it truly great again. But I don't care. I'm in for the ride. It's like a sort of, it's like I'm sledging. It's like I'm sledging down a hill. I'm sitting on a sledge. You know those things that you ride in the snow? It's made of wood and you sit on it and you slide down a hill when it's covered in snow. Sledging. I feel like I'm sledging when it comes to Star Wars. It's kind of like it's gradually going downhill, but I'm enjoying the ride. That's how I feel about it. So The Force Awakens was a kind of a nostalgic romp through the Star Wars universe with certain mysterious new elements, including the character Rey, who apparently is Force sensitive. Oh, I'm feeling a bit Force sensitive today. It's like, I'm not going to come and play football. I'm feeling a bit Force sensitive. She's a bit Force sensitive. We don't know why. Who is she? Why is she so strong in the Force? There's this emo gothic guy called Kylo Ren, who is Han Solo's son, and he's a bit of a naughty boy. He's turned to the dark side, and Luke Skywalker's disappeared. What's going on? Okay, so it was basically a rehashing of the storyline from the original film, if you think about it. I'm not going to go into the details, but it basically is exactly the same as A New Hope with a few other bits and pieces thrown in. And then you got The Last Jedi, which just totally divided opinion. Critics liked it, but everyone else seemed to think it was shit. Well, not everyone else. A lot of people enjoyed it, but there was a large contingent online who passionately hated it. And so there's tons of YouTube videos of people ranting against it. And I can understand. I totally can, actually, now in hindsight. I can understand why they would find it annoying that throughout almost the entire film, there was basically a low-speed space chase between two massive ships, or fleets of ships, that are going really slowly, but it's like they can't catch up with each other. So it's just like nothing's happening. They're just floating through space really slowly until eventually the big evil ship manages to blow up one or two of the other ones. And then they've got a race against time and they have to escape down to a planet that, oh, no one noticed before. And, you know, it's weird, bizarre storytelling. And there's that whole section in the middle where, what's his name, Finn and Rose go off to that sort of casino planet, and there's lots of very bad CGI, and then a weird sort of horse escape sequence, and it's all a bit Disney, and that's the worst part of the film. But then there are some really cool parts as well, like there's the sort of stuff where Rey and, what's his name, Kylo, end up killing Snoke and having a big sort of acrobatic fight with those guys in red costumes, and one of them gets chucked into a sort of a blender and he gets all chopped up, which is pretty good. And another one gets his head chopped off and the room catches fire, and then they have like a sort of an argument, and that's pretty cool. And also I quite like the stuff with Luke Skywalker. I enjoy the fact that he is kind of a cynical Jedi, that when you really think about the Jedi, they are responsible for creating all the Sith and for the creation of Darth Vader, and they are sort of blind and a bit arrogant and all that kind of thing, and they don't own the Force. And that if you that essentially the Force is all about balance, it should be anyway. And you know, I kind of understand that, but still I can understand why people didn't like it. So now here we are. We're back with part 3, episode 9 now, which is supposed to conclude the whole Skywalker narrative arc. It's going to conclude in this episode. So in terms of the Skywalkers, we've got obviously Kylo Ren, who is Ben Skywalker, Ben Solo. But he is a Skywalker because his mum is Princess Leia, who apparently is still alive in this film. But I don't know how they're doing that, considering Carrie Fisher died just after the last film was released. Apparently they're using old footage and somehow repurposing it. So Kylo Ren is a Skywalker. Then, of course, there's Luke Skywalker, who seemed to die at the end of the last episode, The Last Jedi. He sort of disappeared. Maybe he'll be back as a Force ghost or something. And then there is, of course, Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader. So I don't know if we're going to see Darth Vader in the episode, but it'll be interesting to see. But the episode is called The Rise of Skywalker. So does this mean Kylo Ren is going to become a good guy in the end? He's going to become... But he's not really a Skywalker, is he? Maybe it's going to be something about Anakin. I don't know. Could it be possible for the guy, the actor who played Anakin, could he come back? That would be good. I think that would be good. I don't know how they would do that, though. And maybe Rey is a Skywalker after all. We don't know. But the new trailer... I mean, there are... I guess the thing we already knew was that the Emperor was back, right? Because at the end of the last trailer, there was like the Emperor's laughter. His cackling laughter in the background. It's like, oh my God, the Emperor is back. So, well... What's going to happen with this new Star Wars film? Is it going to be any good? Is it possible to rescue the Star Wars franchise after the sort of weird and enjoyable for me, but slightly odd, unconventional last episode? And the fact that the first episode brought up these questions that still haven't been properly answered. What's his name? Who's the director? J.J. Abrams. So one good thing is that I think he's a good director. I trust him. He's able to handle large action set pieces. He's very good at sort of, you know, creating a sense of mystery. But that's kind of the problem with him as well, is that he's good at setting up a mystery that everyone needs to solve. Like with The Force Awakens, it was like, who is Rey? Who are her parents? Who is Snoke? What's he actually doing? You know, all this stuff. There are tons of theories. He's very good at creating a mystery, just like he did with the TV series Lost, where everyone's like puzzled and trying to work out what's going on. But he's not so good at tying up all the loose ends and sort of resolving a story in a conclusive way. So that's a bit of a worry. Maybe it's going to be a muddled fudge of an ending. We don't know. But I'm a bit concerned about that. What else? So The Rise of Skywalker, which Skywalker? We don't know. The Emperor is back. And there are various predictions about how the Emperor could come back. Maybe he is, maybe he's a clone, because I think there is some precedent in terms of the like books or something that, or comic books that the Emperor clones himself, and so he returns like that. Or maybe the Emperor somehow his Force essence has been sort of kept, or it's moved to another person. Maybe he's able to like move his essence to another person. And there's all this stuff about Darth Plagueis who managed to avoid, he managed to cheat death or something. So maybe he's learned how to cheat death. What happened to the Emperor? At the end of Return of the Jedi, Darth Vader throws him sort of down into the middle of the Death Star, and he seems to blow up, but we don't actually see his body. So apparently he didn't die, or maybe if he did die, his Force essence has remained somehow. But it seems that he's still around because you hear his voice, right? So maybe he didn't die. Now, the best theory that I've heard about this, my favorite theory that I've heard, is by those guys from Red Letter Media. I don't know if you know Red Letter Media, but it's a YouTube channel, and they do movie reviews. And they're kind of a group of schlubby, geeky American guys from somewhere up in the North Midwest, like somewhere near like Milwaukee or something like that, Wisconsin, somewhere like that, you know. And these kind of schlubby guys who drink beer and they discuss films, but they're very funny. And also they're often really correct, really accurate in their predictions. And I love this prediction that they have of how the Emperor might have come back. So I'll just sort of give you the rundown of what their prediction is. So the Emperor apparently died in the second Death Star, when he was thrown into like a big, like a lift shaft or something by Darth Vader. And then the Death Star was destroyed, of course, by the rebels. In the film, the Death Star seems to just turn into dust, right? It just explodes. But it seems in the trailer that there's bits of the Death Star lying on some planet. And it looks like a planet with trees on it. There's water there as well, but it could be the moon forest of Endor, which is where the second Death Star was when it was destroyed. So maybe parts of the Death Star crash landed on the moon forest of Endor. at the end of Return of the Jedi. Now, what do we know about the moon forest of Endor? The moon forest planet? I'm saying the moon forest. The forest moon. Luke, what are you talking about? The moon forest of Endor. Please disregard every time I said the moon forest of Endor. Please replace it with the forest moon of Endor. Okay, because the moon forest of Endor doesn't make any sense. A moon forest would be a forest made out of moons, which would be very strange. Like you're walking through a forest and it's not trees, it's just moons. That's a moon forest. So no, not a moon forest. A forest moon. It's a moon that's a forest. So that's where the Death Star may have crashed. Now, what do we know about Endor? Well, we know that it's home to loads of Ewoks. Okay, so the theory goes like this. Maybe what's happened is that the Emperor, right, he's like not dead, but he's in the remains of the Death Star on Endor. He's like badly injured, physically very hurt, but he's using his force powers to keep himself alive, to preserve his life, but he's very weak. And he's really down to just like his essence in physical form as well. And he sends out like evil, bad force vibes around him. And he corrupts the local Ewok population. And the Ewoks come to kind of worship the Emperor. And they build a sort of primitive throne for him in the remains of the Death Star. And they come in their droves and they worship him. You can imagine them kind of, you know, doing their kind of chanting and they're bowing and worshipping, you know, the way Ewoks do. And they worship him and he kind of feeds off them. They make sacrificial offerings to him of other Ewoks, and he kind of feeds on the Ewoks, and he also feeds on them through his force power, and they become kind of like they become all sort of emaciated and thin and like evil and dark, and they've got like glowing red eyes, and they've got like dark skin, and they become evil Ewoks, and that's how he kind of like manages to build up his power again over a 40-year period, and then he comes back and he's kind of like returned to his full strength because of his Ewok like cult that has been nurturing him back to life. I mean, they're not going to do that in the film, but oh my God, I hope they do. I think that would be amazing, don't you think? Like, that could be genuinely really quite scary. It could be really creepy and scary, and I think it would be brilliant, but they're obviously not going to do it, which is a pity. But I've no idea what they're going to do. I mean, the Emperor's back, and so what? I mean, does it feel a bit like desperate sort of storytelling? Like, come on, you just bring back the Emperor. Let's try and get this thing back on track. I mean, obviously, I'm excited and I can't wait to see what happens. And as I said before, I feel like I've got nothing to lose. And so if it's an absolute turkey, I'll be disappointed. If it's completely terrible, I will be disappointed. But, you know, I'm looking forward to exploring the final chapter in this particular Star Wars story. And I just really hope that J.J. Abrams doesn't spoil it. I saw something on, I think it was on Twitter or YouTube. Someone wrote a funny comment. And the comment goes like this. The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, The Rise of Skywalker seems like a barely cobbled together sentence about Luke getting out of bed. Sounds like Luke getting out of bed. The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, The Rise of Skywalker. It does sound like Luke Skywalker getting out of bed, doesn't it? All right, moving on. I've been rambling for nearly an hour now, and I've just got like a couple of other things to do at the end here. Okay, I think this is going to be one episode. How are you, ladies and gents? Are you enjoying this ramble? I know it's been very specific. I've gone through sort of topics that, I'd be lucky if I captured everyone's attention and agreement all the way through this episode. I feel like it's a minefield. Brexit and politics, oh dear. Talking about technical microphones and things, you're going to lose some people with that one. The rock music biography and the Beatles' sort of geeky re-release of one of their albums. And then Star Wars, Luke. Well, those of you who are still here, I'm glad that you are still here, ladies and gents. And I love you for continuing to listen through my inane ramblings. And, you know, if you want content from me that is more to the point and succinct, then you could consider becoming a premium subscriber. I've recently started doing a series of little pronunciation videos, which are just a few minutes long. And it's basically just a few sentences from previous pronunciation drill sections of previous premium episodes, five, six or seven sentences, drilled with attention to connected speech, weak forms, sentence stress, intonation, and how to say the sentences just like me. And so that's fun, and I'm still doing those. There'll be another one of those coming this week. That'll be the third one. So you can get that by going to teacherluke.co.uk/premium. And finally, I wanted to play some clips from this video, which I discovered yesterday. I think it's a new video. This is a video of Bill Bailey, who I've talked about several times on this podcast. I did a whole episode about him. Was it one or two? Maybe it was two parts. I can't remember. I think it was two parts. He's a stand-up comedian who specializes in using music in his comedy, and he's an excellent musician. He plays piano, guitar, all sorts of instruments, and he likes to deconstruct music. And I found this video on... Hold on. Okay, it's on Classic FM. Classic FM is a radio station that you can find in the UK and probably online, and they play classical music. And in this one, they interviewed Bill Bailey. They gave him 10 random questions, and Bill chooses to answer the questions through music. So it's 10 random questions answered through music with Bill Bailey. And this is really interesting for me for several reasons. One, it's just really funny. And two, it's very insightful about music. And thirdly, there's lots of nice vocab in here. So I'm going to go through some little parts of this video with you before we end the episode. So I think we're going to start with the most beautiful melody. So the question is, what is the most beautiful melody? And let's just see how Bill answers this question with the use of his piano.
No, it's a beautiful melody. It's difficult, isn't it? I did for a while think that it's, you know, O mio bambino caro, you know, the Puccini aria, you know, like... But actually, when you're talking about the melody, if you take away the harmony, the melody isn't quite, it doesn't quite stand up, you know. It needs the harmony to give it sort of resonance. So actually, I'm sort of thinking it possibly could be, and I know this sounds like it's such a cliche almost, and it's so well known and well revered, but, you know, Harold Arlen's beautiful melody, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, stands up on its own. You know, straight away. You know, you get the sense of the song just from the melody. And it's sort of, it the idea of this big octave leap of the melody suggests leaping over a rainbow. And it's sort of immediately sad. Drops down immediately from the octave. And there's another little leap there, sort of, and it gradually comes down the whole octave. So it's a beautifully constructed, very simple melody, but it sort of, it mimics, it suggests the lyric in a beautiful way.
Wow, that's really nice, don't you think? It struck me yesterday when I watched that it's just a very eloquent way of describing melody. And, you know, listening to those two melodies. The first one is an aria from, I guess, an opera. And we'll just listen to that little section again. I'm going to break it down now and just just repeat some of the things that you hear. When I break down audio like this on the podcast, sometimes I'm explaining. Sometimes I just repeat what the person said. And I expect that often that's enough, right, for you, that you might not be able to catch what the original person said, but when I repeat it, you're able to understand it. So sometimes I don't need to do much more than just repeat what's been said, but then there are times when I need to explain it too. So let's listen to him answering that question about the most beautiful melody again, and we'll kind of break it down too. So I mean, just before we do, the idea of the of a melody, though, is an interesting one. When you think about melody in music, the melody is such an important part of a song, and there are numerous memorable melodies. But a melody is an interesting thing. It kind of tells a little story rather than like harmony, which provides context, you know, harmonic chords, and rhythm, which provides sort of a sense of tension or movement. But the melody is sort of giving you the main points of the story. And so it does tell a little story as it goes up and down, it goes here and there. So it's interesting to consider a melody. The first one that he plays, I think, is a really beautiful melody. And I find it's actually more beautiful than the Somewhere Over the Rainbow one. Let's just hear what he says.
No, it's a beautiful melody. It's difficult, isn't it? I did for a while think that it's, you know, Oh Mio Bambino Caro, you know, the Puccini aria, you know, like... it's a beautiful aria, but actually, when you're talking about the melody, if you take away the harmony, the melody isn't quite, it doesn't quite stand up, you know.
The melody doesn't quite stand up. It's quite an interesting turn of phrase. If something stands up, it means it kind of, it can rest on its own. It doesn't need other things to support it. Now, in this case, he's talking about a melody that doesn't quite stand up on its own. But we also use the expression to talk about things that are not really believable. So it doesn't really stand up as evidence, you might say, meaning it won't function as evidence. And if you'd say someone's story doesn't really stand up, it means that the story falls down, is structurally something wrong with it, so that it's probably not true. So anyway, the melody needs the harmony. It doesn't really stand up on its own.
Needs the harmony to give it sort of resonance. So actually, I'm sort of thinking it possibly could be...
That's quite a nice sentence, isn't it? It's not really a sentence, but I mean, if you're looking for phrases that we use when we're trying to think, there you go.
Harmony to give it sort of resonance. So actually, I'm sort of thinking it possibly could be... And I know this sounds like it's such a cliche almost.
Cliche, obviously, something that's been done so many times is unoriginal.
It's so well known and well revered.
Something is revered, it means that, like, you know, people consider it to be really great. They have very high opinions of it. He's talking about Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's kind of a cliche, but it is very well revered.
But, you know, Harold Arlen's beautiful melody, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, stands up on its own. You know, straight away. You know, you get the sense of the song just from the melody, and it's sort of it the idea of this big octave leap.
So a leap is basically a big jump, okay? If you can imagine sort of leaping over a huge puddle on the ground, you'd have to leap forwards. So you're talking about the octave leap, the doo-doo. It leaps all the way up an octave.
Of the melody suggests leaping over a rainbow, and it's sort of immediately sad, drops down immediately from the octave. And there's another little leap there, sort of. And it gradually comes down the whole octave. So it's a beautifully constructed, very simple melody, but it sort of, it mimics, it suggests the lyric in a beautiful way.
It mimics the lyric. So to mimic something is to kind of like do an impersonation of something, to copy something. And it suggests the lyric. It's just a nice little, for me, unexpected level of musical analysis that I got while I was eating my lunch yesterday that I wanted to share with you in the podcast today. There's more. The next question is basically, what is it? If your life was a piece of music, what would it be? If your life was a piece of music, what would it be? And I just love the way he answers this question by talking about parts of his life, you know, how he grew up in the countryside, and it was a very idyllic kind of rural situation. Idyllic means kind of perfect, and rural meaning in the countryside. So it's an idyllic rural upbringing, And then the music, you know, he expresses this in this kind of floral sounding, rural sounding music. And then there's the sense that as you grow up, you get more responsibilities and the music changes to suit that. And there, he has some very nice turns of phrase as well while he's explaining all of this. I'll let listen to that now.
I think life is, for my life's been, I've been very lucky. So it started out with, I think I was just playing earlier. Debussy's L'Arabesque, and I think that's because it started with this sort of beautiful kind of like a rural idyll that I lived in. I grew up in the countryside and it was sort of worry-free and sort of, you know, carefree, and I grew up in lovely fields and the countryside. And then there's sort of like that moment in it which is a bit more serious, and that's when life takes on a bit more responsibility. And then but now I'm back to full circle. I'm enjoying the natural world more, so I'd say perhaps that.
Absolutely brilliant. I have to say, the man is a legend. Let's just listen to that little bit again, because it's just worth just taking a little bit of time, you know, just going fairly slowly and listening to these little bits again. So he said it was an idyll, a rural idyll. I-D-Y-L-L is how you spell that. An extremely happy, peaceful or picturesque period or situation, usually in the countryside. Okay, so a lovely, perfect little rural place that he grew up in.
I think life is, for my life's been, I've been very lucky. So it started out with, I think I was just playing earlier.
It started out with, and then he says, I think as I was playing earlier. And then he quickly runs through a bit of Debussy, I think that he was playing earlier. He plays it fairly quickly because he's not really performing it. He's just more sort of, you know, just bringing it up.
You know, Debussy's L'Arabesque. And I think that's because it started with this sort of beautiful kind of like a rural idyll that I lived in. I grew up in the countryside. And it was sort of worry-free and sort of, you know, carefree. And I grew up in lovely fields and the countryside. And then there's sort of like, there's that moment in it which is a bit more serious. And that's when life takes on a little bit more responsibility.
And that's when life takes on a bit more responsibility. If you take something on, it's like you carry it with you. It's when life takes on a bit more responsibility.
And then but now I'm back to full circle. I'm enjoying the natural world more, so I'd say perhaps that.
I think that's just beautiful. I think just the two themes, the rural one and then the more serious one and then back to the rural one. It just seems to be like a lovely little story. And that rural music reminds me of The Legend of Zelda, actually.
The natural world more, so I'd say perhaps that.
Now, my favourite one that he does is answering the question, what is the sound of London, right? What does London sound like? Here it is. What is the sound of London? Okay, now this is brilliant because it does showcase Bill Bailey's talent and he's got it spot on, I think. So imagine London, right? I don't know if you know the city, if you've been there, if you've lived there and worked there, but just think of London. What music for you defines London? Now, what is the sound of London? Some of you will be thinking it's all kind of like pompous, like old-fashioned, maybe like a royal national anthem, pom pom, you know, like kind of like God Save the Queen, that kind of thing is probably what some of you are thinking of. But don't forget that London is not just the tourist place that you know it as. That London is the beating heart of London is probably in the city, where there's people doing business and there's also a thriving arts scene and, you know, lots of artists and commentators, journalists, writers, and just everything, industry, and it's a very vibrant place. So how would you put that into music. Well, let's listen to how Bill Bailey does it. We'll listen once and then we'll probably break it down again. And then I expect that will be the end of the episode. Okay, so what is the Sound of London?
Sound of London. Well, London is always moving. It's restless, you know. It's got a kind of pulse to it. Sort of it's quite cool as well. It's quite stylish, timeless London. So I always think of London as, you know, it's kind of like a slightly dissonance, but also kind of a cool, almost like a jazz vibe to it. Perhaps I could even appropriate some sort of jazz piano sounds here. One of the electric size. Well, how about this? Oh yeah, there we go. See. Of course, it's a bit innovative, so of course, you know, sometimes you get something. You know, you can get that sort of thing. London's quite sort of contemplative sometimes, but mainly it's the rhythm.
He does a funny face at the end when it kind of changes and goes serious. Again, that's just brilliant. I've never heard anything like it, I have to say. Someone interpreting the sound of London in such a way, and it makes total sense to me. It is kind of hip and cool and quite serious and a bit avant-garde and all these things, you know. So it's right that he's got that kind of avant-garde jazz sort of thing going on. And then the other weird, those strange chords, ambient sounding stuff, which is, it kind of makes you think of the contemplative side of the city. Just wonderful. And some nice vocab. Let's go through that again.
Sound of London. Well, London is always moving. It's restless.
Right. London's always moving. We understand. London is restless, which is a nice phrase to feel restless. It feels like, you know, you're not able to relax. You kind of you've got a bit too much energy. Right. So if you imagine like lying in bed with someone who's restless, they might be kind of tossing and turning in bed, moving around and stuff and being generally restless. London is a restless place, always moving. There's always this hum, this kind of sound of like just London moving and doing things. And yeah, so London's always moving. It's restless.
You know, it's got a kind of pulse to it.
It's got a kind of pulse to it. Pulse is obviously the sound of a heartbeat. Right, that's a pulse, but it's a pulse can also just be a regular sort of a rhythm, okay? Just this regular driving rhythm, like a heartbeat.
It's got a sort of it's quite cool as well. It's quite stylish, timeless London. So I always think of London as.
It's cool. It's stylish. It's timeless. He said, right, which is, you know, that sense that it's kind of got this. Something that about it that will never age, like certain kinds of classical music, or arguably, you know, maybe the Beatles is timeless because, I mean, Abbey Road came out again this year and it immediately went to number one. So the appeal of the Beatles appears to be timeless. But London is, yeah, it's kind of cool and timeless.
You know, it's kind of like a slightly dissonance.
Dissonance is basically when... like notes are played together that don't really go together. So it's like a lack of harmony. It's the opposite of harmony. And sometimes dissonance can be used in music to create a sort of edgy feeling or exactly a sense of dissonance, of things crashing together and stuff, like he says.
Think of London as, you know, it's kind of like a slightly dissonance, but also kind of a cool, almost like a jazz vibe to it. Perhaps I could even appropriate some sort of jazz piano sounds here.
To appropriate something is to basically kind of take it and use it for yourself. So he's just reprogramming his keyboard to get some of those cheesy electric piano sounds. It's something like a Rhodes piano simulator.
Yeah, one of the electric size. Well, how about this? Oh, yeah, there we go. See? And then, of course, it's a bit innovative, so, of course, you know, sometimes you get something. You know, you can get that sort of thing. bit sort of contemplative sometimes, but mainly it's the rhythm.
Okay, so ladies and gents, thank you for joining me on this mega ramble that I've been doing for the last hour and 20 minutes. It's been enjoyable. It's been emotional. I feel like maybe I've touched some of you out there. If you feel like you've been touched by me, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. It's just my arm brushed, up against you there when I was just trying to change the volume on the mixer. And sorry, so if I have touched anyone, I do apologize. Okay, an official apology is in order. I'm sorry. Okay, don't roast me on Twitter or whatever it is that you people do these days. So thank you again for listening. If you'd like to get more content from me, then you could sign up to LEP Premium. It's really simple. teacherluke.co.uk/premium. Sign up and you'll get access to all of the premium content, including those pronunciation videos and all the other normal premium episodes I'm doing. Premium Series 17 is coming this week, I expect. So if you want to get it, just get it. It's easy, simple. It's about the price of about a coffee a month from you to me, which is not a lot. And there's tons of stuff in there now. I've got loads of episodes. I think it's more than 50, I think. Yeah, I think you'll find. I can't even remember. It's maybe even 60. Spread out across about 16 series of episodes with loads of good stuff. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Thank you for listening, folks. You're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. And I hope you have a lovely day or morning or night or evening, whatever it is you're doing, wherever you are in the world. And I'll speak to you again in the next episode of Luke's English Podcast. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye.
Lord, I'm a rambling man. Don't fool around with a rambling man.
Hello, so this is a little Easter egg here at the end. This is actually not the end of the episode. I've decided to do a little Easter egg because actually I wanted to go through the trailer for the new Star Wars film, the new trailer. I actually intended to do that in the episode, but I just got so caught up in whatever it was I was talking about that I forgot to do it. But I think I can just do it now at the end. So this is where I'm actually going to go through the new trailer, sort of bit by bit. We'll listen to it and I'll talk a little bit about little things, little theories and stuff. And then that will be the end of the episode properly. So here we go. We start on what sounds like the forest moon of Endor. Not the moon forest of Endor, Luke. What are you talking about? The forest moon of Endor, it looks like. You can hear the sound of the forest. And then suddenly a helmet drops to the ground and it looks like maybe a sort of a training helmet or maybe one of the helmets that they used to use when they were doing those like speeders through the forest in Return of the Jedi. You know, the pilots of those speeders had certain helmets. It looks kind of like one of those or maybe a helmet that a Jedi trainee would use. Is that the right word? Trainee? Intern? The Jedi intern. Might use one of those to do training. So there's going to be a little bit of noise as the helmet drops to the ground. And then we see Rey running through the forest with a lightsaber. And it looks like she's training with one of those like training droids that you see in Star Wars. It's like a little globe that shoots red lasers. And it looks like she's sort of defending herself against one of these things. So it looks like a training sequence on the forest moon of Endor or another similarly forested place.
It's an instinct.
Now, I wasn't sure who this was at the beginning saying it's an instinct, but I think it's Poe, and I think he's talking about his friendship with Rey. So we see Rey sort of jumping during what could be training on a forest planet somewhere, and then it cuts to her jumping inside the remains of some kind of spaceship, a bit like in episode 7 when she was like climbing around inside the remains of a Star Destroyer. I think that she might be in the second Death Star at this point, kind of climbing around doing something. We don't know what she's doing.
Feeling. The Force brought us together.
the Force brought us together. This is Finn, and he's kind of with some of the others, and they're staring off into the distance, looking at something.
We're not alone.
So this is Poe now, the ace pilot who's sort of becoming a leader of the rebellion. He's saying, is it the rebellion or the resistance, isn't it? It's the resistance. We're not alone. So he's giving a sort of rousing speech here, which also suggests that there's probably more members of the resistance than there were at the end of the last film, because it was really just a handful of people on the Millennium Falcon. I think this film takes place 2 years after. So there are probably other people that have sort of come in, including Lando Calrissian, who we can see sitting in the middle of the picture. So I think there's probably more now to the resistance. They've gathered together all the disparate bands of rebels from around the universe.
Good people will fight if we lead them.
People keep telling me they know me.
People keep telling me they know me. And this is Rey talking. People keep telling me they know me. And you can see images of her walking across what could be remains of the second Death Star with big waves crashing against it. So she's walking along saying, people keep telling me they know me.
No one does.
But no one does. And she's standing there on... I mean, it looks a bit like a submarine being smashed by waves, but I think it's part of the second Death Star, remains of it.
But I do.
So this is Kylo saying, I know you. So we still don't know the relationship between Rey and Kylo. I mean, is it interesting? Is it not interesting? It's curious. I mean, there was a suggestion in the last one, there was like sort of weird sexual tension between the two of them. But maybe it's going to be revealed in classic Star Wars fashion that actually they're brother and sister. So it'd be, oh, that's awkward. Remember that scene where he's kind of topless? Oh, no, that's a bit awkward. They're actually brother and sister. You know, you need a little bit of sort of possible incest in a show, don't you? I mean, that was the appeal of Game of Thrones, wasn't it? Largely. Certainly in the beginning, it's like, oh, a bit of sort of sexy incest stuff going on. But there's always been a little hint of that in Star Wars, but never too much. So anyway, I don't know what's going on between the two of them. You know, no, people keep telling me they know who I am, but no one knows who I am. And Kylo's like, but I know. All right. I know who you are. I know what you want. You want, actually, I don't know what you want. What do you want, Rey? What does Rey really want? She just wants to defeat the bad guys and learn who she is. Okay. Let's good luck with that. There's Kylo Ren looking pretty cool. He looks like a samurai or something. And then we have footage of like loads of TIE fighters flying through what looks like a frozen place. And then a picture of a big throne. And this looks like maybe the Emperor's new throne. I don't think the thing about the Ewoks I was talking about, I don't think that's going to come true, unfortunately. But there's a big throne. Could be the Emperor's throne.
Long have I waited.
Long have I waited.
So there you go. You see the Emperor using an inversion, right?
Long, long have I waited.
You see, the Emperor's very strong in the Force. I mean, I think he's much stronger than Yoda because, you know, as we know, Yoda, it's not that strong because you can't lift the verb into the middle of the sentence. But the Emperor's kind of doing all sorts of clever sentence structure here and using the old, you know, inversion there.
Long have I waited. Long have I waited.
I can't really do the Emperor.
Long have I waited.
Can't do it. The only line of the Emperor's that I can do is when he, I think, I'm not sure he says this, but he says something like this. He says, oh, I think you'll find this battle station is fully operational. He says something like that in Return of the Jedi. You know, he kind of starts like this. Oh, I think you'll find, young Master Jedi, that this battle station is fully operational. You know, going from this kind of thing to this sort of thing. I might try and use that sometimes at work, maybe, you know, if someone doesn't do their homework. Oh, I think you'll find that you'll be doing your homework all weekend. I don't know how that would go down. But anyway, what is it? Long have I waited.
Long have I waited.
Long have I waited.
It's like that, isn't it?
Waited. Long have I waited.
That's how the Emperor speaks.
Long have I waited for this moment. It's sort of like this, isn't it?
It's like his tongue is stuck to the bottom of his mouth and he can't move it.
My tongue is stuck to the bottom of my mouth and I can't move it.
That's how you do an Emperor impression. Stick the tongue to the bottom of your mouth.
Stick your tongue to the bottom of your mouth.
And now, you're coming together.
And now, you're coming together.
And now you're coming together. Now, this is interesting from a grammatical point of view, again, of course, because we're dealing with the Emperor here. So he has immaculate grammar. And now you're coming together. Now, that sounds to me like he's saying, and now you are coming together. So he's talking, we see images of like the team together, Poe and Finn and Rey and Chewbacca. And now you're coming together. It sounds like you are coming together, but no, it's not, because as we hear from the rest of the sentence, he actually says, now you're coming together, like you're the possessive pronoun, which is an interesting bit of sentence structure. Now you're coming together, and how does he conclude the sentence?
You're coming together.
Your coming together is your undoing.
Your coming together is your undoing. So it's the possessive pronoun, your. And you can do that. You can do a possessive pronoun plus an ing, right? That becomes a sort of like a noun. Sorry for my asking, you know, like sorry for my interrupting, but do you have blah, 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 you know? I hope you don't mind my asking, you see. So it's like, I hope you don't mind something. And that something can be my doing something. I hope you don't mind my smoking in the office, as the Emperor might say. You know, I hope you don't mind my smoking in the office. No, go ahead. That's go right ahead. Please be my guest, you know. Yes, there you go. So you're coming together will be your end. Now, who's coming together? Does he mean the coming together of the team of Rey and Finn and Poe and Lala and Tinky Winky and that's the Teletubbies, isn't it? Sorry. Who? Or does he mean Rey and Kylo? Because maybe Rey and Kylo are going to team up to try and defeat the Emperor. I've no idea what's going to happen, and I can't wait to find out.
What are you doing there, 3PO?
What are you doing? Naturalistic dialogue. Naturalistic delivery of naturalistic dialogue. That's how you do naturalistic dialogue. You just do you're kind of giving away the lines just without really thinking about it. You know, just naturally. I guess I'm just going to make a cup of tea if anyone wants some. What you doing there, 3PO? So, what you doing there? That's how you do naturalistic dialogue.
What are you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir. At my friends.
Ooh. What you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir. At my friends.
So what's going to happen to 3PO? Are we going to sacrifice 3PO or something? Or maybe 3PO is just extremely pessimistic before the mission that they're about to go on. And he's like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just taking one last look at my friends because you're all going to die. Maybe he's being very pessimistic. Or maybe 3PO is going to somehow be sacrificed here. Now, they've kind of hooked him up. They've like attached an Ethernet cable to the back of his head or something. They've hooked him up to the Matrix. Maybe what they're going to do is somehow use C-3PO's memory banks in order to like locate the Emperor or something like that. I don't know, but they're going to use 3PO because he's been there sort of from the start. He was there with Anakin, obviously, in episode one. And then he's followed all of this all the way through the whole thing. Him and R2-D2 as well. So maybe he's got like memory banks and stuff. Maybe he's seen things they need to access. So, and maybe that's going to destroy his memory in the process. We don't know. But can't they just back him up to like an external hard drive and then do that? They don't have to wipe his memory, do they?
This Christmas.
So there was like awesome looking sequence there of like our heroes running through what looks like a big battle station or something and shooting loads of stormtroopers. It's like real Star Wars nostalgia in overdrive. Like a corridor that looks exactly like something out of the Death Star from the original Star Wars. And you've got Chewbacca and Poe and Tinky Winky and La La and the other Teletubbies running through this set with like stormtroopers falling on the floor. It's classic Star Wars. And then we see Princess Leia. I don't know, as I said before, somehow they're going to fit her into the film with old footage. But she's there hugging Rey.
Confronting fear. Destiny of a Jedi.
And that's Luke Skywalker with new dialogue. Confronting fear is the destiny of a Jedi.
Confronting fear is the destiny of a Jedi.
So I get, what's this? Is this Luke Skywalker as a Force ghost giving Rey a kind of a motivational pep talk? You know, like, I know that you're really scared. I know that it's the Emperor and he's like the most powerful. You know, he does that lightning thing. Ah, and it's really horrible. And he sort of speaks like this. You know, he's horrible. So you must be absolutely filling your trousers on this one, Rey. So, but just remember that confronting fear is the destiny of a Jedi, which basically means you've got no choice. You've got to do it or we will cut your legs off with a lightsaber. Because that's, you know, it's the thing about being a Jedi. You can't just leave. You can't, you know, we're not just going to let you leave. You have to face the Emperor. Sorry.
Your destiny.
So your destiny. So apparently, well, Rey is a Jedi. Is she the last Jedi? I still don't really understand the title of the previous film. But then we get shots of like awesome battle sequences. I'm sure there'll be big action set pieces. There's shots of spaceships flying through space and different types of thing. There's a shot of like some horses riding across what looks like a Star Destroyer. Is that possible? Are they on the top of a Star Destroyer, a big load of horses? I mean, this is a Disney production, so obviously they've got to try and get some horseback riding in there somehow. Maybe there's another princess involved in this. We don't know yet. But horses, okay. I mean, that's for those people who didn't like the horse-based sequence in the previous film, they will not be happy to see the reappearance of some sort of equine element in this film. What else is going to happen? The saga will end, it says. I can't wait to see what happens. How are they going to end this? What kind of botched job are they going to do on this? I can't wait. Right, so there's a really, really interesting clip there. So we see Rey and Kylo in this weird white room. It looks like nothing we've ever seen before. Maybe something from the original Death Star, but it's all white and super Star Wars-y in its design, but it's all white. Normally they're kind of grey, aren't they, those Imperial spaceships? And they appear to be maybe having a lightsaber fight in this environment. Rey is in her normal gear. Kylo is in his normal stuff, but he's got his helmet on. This is the helmet that he's repaired. I don't know why he didn't just get a new helmet, but he's repaired this one after he smashed it in the last film. And they're maybe fighting or something. And then there's this, what looks like a big sort of statue made of black glass or something. And it's, you don't see it very, very long. It's a very quick clip. And it could be like Darth Vader, like a statue of Darth Vader or something. But it quickly gets smashed by their lightsabers. I think either they both smash it or that they're fighting and they smash it by accident. And maybe what this is it's a sort of a statue maybe holding Darth Vader's helmet, because remember, Kylo Ren had Vader's helmet and he was worshipping it, and he had it on like a little bed of stones. It was quite a nice little stone garden he'd built for it. Maybe now it's on this kind of glass plinth, but it seems to be that the maybe Vader's helmet is involved here again somehow, and it gets broken, maybe smashed or something. Maybe what's got happened with the Emperor is that he transferred his force essence to Vader's helmet, because you remember when Vader throws him over the balcony, you see his skull kind of full of electricity and stuff. Maybe the Emperor's force spirit went into the helmet, and so that's the kind of driving force, the evil force that's been sort of pushing all of this forwards. We don't know. So maybe the helmet's going to make a recurrence. And then, like, scenes of a massive space fight, and then a very, very weird shot of, like, Rey standing on the ground, and then we're looking over the shoulder of what looks like the Emperor, because you see, like, the black cloak and the hood. But maybe he's riding on some kind of big armored suit or a big chair that moves or something. But he appears to be moving towards her, and she's like walking backwards, and he's laughing. Now, is this the Emperor and a special body suit or something? In the previous trailer, there was a shot of Rey as a kind of evil Sith version of Rey, and she's got like a red double bladed lightsaber. So I wonder how that fits into all of this. Is that just a vision of what would happen if she turned to the dark side, or does she actually turn to the dark side in this? And is this the Emperor that we're seeing, or is this maybe Dark Rey or something? What's going to happen?
The Force will be with you
always.
So the Force will be with you always. And that's Luke Skywalker saying the Force will be with you. And then Princess Leia saying always. And you see Rey's face. She's got her lightsaber and maybe she's crying. And she's probably about to do battle with something. So anyway, there you go. I suppose Rey is building up to some big confrontation. Maybe she's going to try and take down the Emperor. Maybe she's going to take down the Emperor and Kylo, or with Kylo. I wonder what's going to happen. And I'm looking forward to it. It could be a huge disappointment. We never know. There's more to the trailer. What's the rest of this here? I could probably just talk over the top. Of a big blue Star Wars slowly disappearing into space. The Rise of Skywalker. There we go. That's the end. December 20. Tickets available now. So there you go. I will be going to see that, of course. And I'll probably talk about it at nauseating length on the podcast. But until next time, I shall bid you farewell. And I'll speak to you again on the podcast soon. This really is the end of the episode now. Okay, thanks for listening. But for now, goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humor and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.